Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. This pandemic has exposed a number of areas where government was simply unprepared despite decades of pandemic preparation. It's also demonstrated a very ungovernmental-like nimbleness in responding to the economics of a pandemic-induced recession. My guest today says there was no pandemic's playbook on how to keep an economy going in a situation like this. And despite the real hardships many are feeling today, he says we've gotten more right than wrong, at least to this point. Economist Joshua Gans is a professor of strategic management at the University of Toronto and has been the chief economist at the university's Creative Destruction Lab. He previously taught at the University of Melbourne and the University of New South Wales and was a visiting researcher at Microsoft Research. He's authored several books on innovation, disruption, information technology, and artificial intelligence. His latest book is titled Economics in the Age of COVID-19. It's published by MIT Press, which examines the issues and intersection between economics and public health during a pandemic. He joins me today on Studio Tulsa. Professor Gans, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Your book is a really interesting combination of critique on how governments, plural, reacted to this pandemic, as well as a primer, I think, for decision-making in the next pandemic. Why did you write Economics in the Age of COVID-19?
Well, there's two answers for that. The first was I didn't know what else to do. So I, during a period of isolation, decided to put my economics explainer hat on and try to process this for both myself and for others. But really, there were just so many issues being thrown at us, so many economic issues, that it seemed to me that there would be some space for a place that sort of just laid them out and tried to relate them to things that we actually know and other trade-offs that we had. And so that's really why I wrote the book, is basically to explain all the different facets of the things going around us during this crisis.
We all know what has gone wrong in this pandemic, from less than transparent information from the originating source of infections to governments slow to begin preparations. Some governments were slow to work on testing, including the United States, and the supply of PPE. But what went right in your view?
Well, actually, I think it has actually been quite surprising how quickly a consensus emerged, especially amongst economists, of the sorts of things we had to do to prop up the economy and allow the economy to shut down in the way that it had to for a few months. And that was, you know, that was not something that was sitting there in the textbooks or anyone had really researched before. But, you know, a lot of economists just came to the same conclusion. We have to stop things from breaking apart. You know, if somebody is furloughed from their job, let's make sure it's just a furlough and they expect to walk back into that job after this is over. If somebody has rent payments due but can't make them, well, let's make sure that they don't get foreclosed upon. And, you know, if the landlord loses a bit, it's not for very long. And if the landlord's got a mortgage, then the banks don't foreclose on that mortgage, especially with interest rates being as low as they are. And so I think that is something that has, at least as we look at it right now, gone right. There's been a lot of activity all around the world. The same thing has been done. You know, we can point at that as a good thing.
Any other areas where you think things went about as well as could be expected?
Well, I actually think for the most part, how quickly the lockdowns occurred was pretty good. I think, you know, it's very easy for someone to look at mathematical models and even on the basis of small numbers of infections say, oh, we should do this now. We should just shut down the economy. We should stop people interacting with one another. But when it comes down to it, is not something you can so easily enforce. People have to buy into it. And that takes some time. But really, when you look at the timeline, it took a few days to get people to that point in a lot of places. Now, it turns out those days and weeks could really matter. In other words, someone who managed to convince their population to shut down a week earlier than others ended up with a much smaller outbreak, which was the whole point. But nonetheless, they were able to do so. But I do, you know, my concern right now is what about the flip side of that, the reopening question, where it's, things are starting to break a little, and I'm not sure what's going to occur as a result of that.
It's really interesting because your first chapter evaluates the trade-offs governments face when first confronting a pandemic, the trade-off between protecting public health and protecting economic activity. Yeah. And of course, thankfully, virtually all governments chose public health over economic activity. But now here we are, we've flattened the curve. It seems like we're right back to chapter one again.
Well, that's the sad part, is in a sense that, you know, there is, if we could sit there and say with hindsight, what should we have done on day one, right there in January? What should we have done? Which is basically a position that Taiwan was in, and maybe no one else. And the answer is you could keep everything open so long as you test and you have contact tracing and you keep the number of infections low. You can keep your internal economy running pretty much as normal. The problem is if you don't do that, the pandemic explodes, you get all these issues, then you have to lock down. And the purpose of locking down is not to sort of end the whole thing, but to move you back to square one. And so it's not just being able to flatten the curve so that we don't overwhelm the healthcare system, which, thank goodness, actually worked out quite well. But it's also saying, okay, then once we've done that, we're prepared during that time to be able to test and other things so that we can safely reopen the economy. And sadly, that has been, you know, very difficult, and it's not clear that is going on. And there are a myriad of constraints for that. But, you know, so we're not quite back at square one, which is now going to pose a big dilemma.
I think a lot of Western nations also had the benefit of not being Italy and perhaps to a lesser extent Spain, where those were the first countries that were really hit hardest.
Right.
And we learned a lot through them. And they probably came closest to their health systems breaking.
Yes, that's right. And you know, thank goodness we could learn that way, that, you know, there was a bit of a headway going on. If there was no Italy and this had hit more simultaneously, or, you know, some of the cases that came into the U.S. had spread more quickly, there wouldn't have been that opportunity to sort of see what a 2-week from now window looked like and say, well, we don't want that.
Well, getting back to that idea of the trade-offs governments face, the second round, which is now you've flattened the curve, which we all know what that means now. We flatten the rate of infection, so it will be a longer, slower pandemic as opposed to one that overwhelms the health systems. We're, again, at that point where there has to be trade-offs made between public health and economic activity. What, in your mind, are the key factors to keep in mind for decision-makers to make at this point?
Well, I think there are two dimensions of doing that. One is, what's the sort of economic need to being able to let people out and interact physically? You know, what value does that have? So if you're already in an industry where people can happily work from home, you know, that's not a very big case for reopening. But if you're in certain manufacturing industries and other things like that, where you really need to have people come into the plant and, and do their job, that's a big case for it. On the flip side of that is, for any of these activities, what is the likelihood that that's going to cause a lot of interactions and a lot of spreading of the virus? And, you know, if you had a manufacturing plant where you could, you know, have good equipment, good protective gear, not have everybody commingle in a lunch space, and so not have a high generation of infections being spread, then you're a good candidate for opening. But if you're in a place where it's a small place, where people are interacting closely and they don't have that protection, which is what I would worry about, say, with a hair salon, that's going to be an issue. Those are the things that you should look at. And basically, you know, the broad thing it means is that you don't want to open the central business district of cities, which are mainly service industries where people can potentially work from home. You don't want to open those up because they're all going to crowd onto public transport, come in, spread the virus, and bring it everywhere else. You want to open anything that looks more essential and needs it or, and is as outlying. The hard question comes to things like schools. Schools are ones we would like to see open, if only for parental sanity, to allow other people to work more properly. But at the same time, we don't know what their infectious properties are. And so that's going to be the hard one.
And, of course, that's the other issue, whereas there are some children that are getting very sick. Most are not. But they can be tremendous vectors for carrying to other populations.
Right. Although we still don't, you know, one of the things we don't know is how whether they are vectors or not. You know, if they don't get symptoms very strongly, that might not make them as infectious. Schools are also a fairly disciplined environment in some sense, in that you might be able to sort of maybe checking temperatures at the door will do most of the job for you, and checking temperatures when you leave. And so there could be ways that can occur. This highlights the biggest theme of this crisis, is that if we knew a lot more, this would be manageable. But the problem we've faced all through this, and we were supposed to improve our knowledge during this period of lockdown as well, is we haven't learned enough of these key facts that will allow us to manage this thing. It's really an information problem.
Also, when you talk about reopening an economy, I think there's also this desire for businesses to go back to the way they did business before the pandemic.
Yeah.
Even in businesses where you really could change the way you do business, where more people work from home, where more people work flexibly. I mean, these are things we've talked about in innovation and productivity for 20 years or more. And yet there are a lot of businesses that just resist that because this is the way we've always done things. And I think you're already seeing a call for a lot of businesses that continue to work remotely want to go back to having the office.
Well, there is value to that. You know, I come out of the university sector. There's been a decade and a half of debate about whether we could go and teach online, and everybody pretty much said it was impossible. Then within a two-week period, that's what we were doing. What are the outcomes of that? We don't know. We know we're missing something. We just don't know what and how to adjust to it. But the one thing we have to face is, well, while there's a pandemic going on, you know, we can't stuff several hundred students into a lecture theater. We can't do that. And so what the alternatives are very difficult. But there is stuff that you miss. I think there is no doubt that for a short period of time you can go online and do these things. But how you actually fundamentally reorganize a business, you know, just think about the introduction of computers into businesses. It took decades for people to work out how to use them.
My guest today is economist Joshua Ganz. He's a professor of strategic management at the University of Toronto and a chief economist at its Creative Destruction Lab. He's the author of Economics in the Age of COVID-19. It's published by MIT Press right now. It's a virtual publication. It will be a book at some point. But he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. I'm going to change subject a little bit. One of the things you advocate, and this really shows up in the U.S.'s preparation, you advocate for price controls on the real essential materials that a country needs to combat a pandemic. This is something the U.S. did not do, and I'm thinking about how states, hospitals, and the federal government were all bidding on personal protective equipment.
Right.
And you said this is really important, and you think about sanitizer and toilet paper in this private sector. I still don't understand toilet paper, but that's let's move on. How would price controls have made a difference on those issues?
Well, you know, so there's a big trade-off. So the reason you don't want price controls is because you want to let high prices attract more production of stuff. So if you want, you know, if you want people to produce more face masks, you want the price to rise so people will end up going and doing that. Now, and that's pretty much probably what the case is on toilet paper or something like that as well. That was a different thing, but it's not pandemic control essential. It's a comfort item. The thing about like face masks or hand sanitizer or any of those equipment going all the way to ventilators is that they are part of the management of the pandemic. So it is normally, you know, basically what happens if the price rises for stuff, who's going to get and purchase them first? Rich people. The problem is that rich people are not the people you necessarily want to have with those things. You know, who do you want to be able to have face masks, for instance? You want to have the people going out and working in the plants and the food supply and all those sorts of things and actually doing the job, not the people who are sitting at their desks. So in that regard, if you let the price rise and the rich people just buy these things because they don't think about it, you end up with a misallocation of these resources. So during these times of crises, for pandemic essential materials that we really want to be very widely used and used in the right place, you know, we can't rely on the price system to get the job done. And so we need something else. And we recognize this in time of war. This is the same thing that occurs during this time of pandemic.
Now, we're also beginning to see the data, the effects of this pandemic recession. In fact, U.S. GDP went down, I think, 4.8% in the first quarter. You write that what we want to avoid is a dark recession, and there's a big discussion on the recession we're seeing, the recession we want to avoid, and what that means. So what is a dark recession, and why do we want to avoid it?
Well, so the recession we're currently getting, it doesn't feel like the same sort of recession because people, you feel that once the economy starts up, people will go back to close to where they were previously. But that at least is the hope. A dark recession is a recession that occurs as a result of, you know, like akin to a natural disaster. Comes in, wipes out a whole lot of infrastructure, wipes out a whole lot of lives, makes it very difficult for people to go to work, etc. In other words, it's a big shock to what we call the supply side of the economy. All of a sudden, we're in a recession, which is a reduction in economic activity, not because people aren't buying enough, but because there isn't enough people around to produce what we used to produce. And, you know, if you let a pandemic run its course and it has worse health, you know, has worse health outcomes, you get that reduction. And that's the sort of thing that we did see in 1918 with the flu pandemic that was global there. People have been able to trace that we got those long reductions in economic activity simply because people were too ill to work or alternatively also too scared to interact with one another. And that's what we're really trying to avoid here by managing the pandemic proactively. So it's like we have a recession, a controlled recession, so that we don't have a real one, which is hard to get out of.
Let me ask you a question, because right now you're seeing a real big push to reopen the economy at a point, like at least in the United States, I'm not sure about Canada, but you know, you talk to public health officials, they say we're really not at the point where we need to be testing-wise to be reopening the economy in a big way. If you have a second closure, doesn't that increase the chances of a dark recession that could last years because people are going to be afraid to go out?
Yes, it certainly can. And, you know, so if you let this run its course and you let it have this public health crisis, it becomes the sort of thing that we can't reopen up. It becomes the thing that lasts 2 to 5 years rather than 1 to 2 years. So that's what you're trying to avoid here. But that said, you know, yes, it's true. There isn't enough testing to reopen, but people are going to want to reopen anyway. And the way I think about it is this, is that governments have to be preparing people for a second lockdown. They have to be saying, we're going to lift it up here, but our expectation is that in a few months, we're going to have to do this again, and we're going to do it fairly rapidly, because as soon as we see an infection breaking out, we don't want to wait 2 weeks until there are big numbers. We want to do it right away. And your job during the summer is to get your house in order, so that you can ride that next lockdown more efficiently. And this is especially true for businesses, because the businesses that are going to be locked down are the ones who have not prepared, who have not got their workers the right equipment, et cetera, to be able to do that.
You write about a pause, and there are certain things that have paused. You mentioned at the top the idea of, you know, we stopped some of the breakage, we offered furloughs instead of just outright pink slips to a lot of the workforce. We did foreclosure controls, but you actually write about an even bigger pause that some countries have done. Other countries have only done a limited amount of a pause. Can you talk about that pause and what that would mean for an economy?
Well, look, at its basis, it's a conceptual idea. You know, we go through recessions or depressions every year. We do one on Christmas Day. Christmas Day, you know, everything gets wiped out. So if you're just looking at the economic statistics, it's like a massive plummet in GDP that day. Right?
Right.
No, it just is. And the point about that is, of course, it's not a problem. Why? Because, you know, 2 days later, the economy is going to be back to normal. Okay? So the idea of a pause is to get that same mentality everywhere. In other words, we want to be able to stop, go akin to vacation, in this case for a month or two, which seems like a ridiculously long time, but it's a thing. There are economies in the world that do shut down for a month.
Yeah, some of the Western European countries, right?
Exactly. You do, and, you know, August in the United States is not exactly the prime working time. So they do these things, and therefore to start up. So we have to then go through the list. What's stopping us from doing that? What's stopping us from doing that is when somebody doesn't get paid for something, they're going to break that relationship. So we have to make sure that doesn't occur, that everybody, for want of a better term, just chills out and says, okay, when you're not going to get paid in the same way for the moment, let's see what we can do. So one way they do that is the government comes in and says, don't worry, if you need cash, we give you cash, you can pay it back later. You know, if the bills are coming in later, we can pay it back later. You don't have to pay your taxes right away. We're going to be the first people not to charge people for stuff. And then, you know, if they're employers, you know, we say to them, look, we will give you a wage subsidy to help if you keep people on rather than let them go. All of that allows you to basically preserve the economy in a sort of frozen state so that then once this is over, everybody can start up again. How well is that going to work? We do not know. We do not know. And there's some varying opinions on it. But it certainly seemed like the right approach.
And it sounds like the U.S. tried to do some of that, although not systematically, and it's first come, first serve, and if you snooze, you lose. And but that has happened to an extent, I guess.
Yes. And I think, look, it's unknown. I mean, part of this can be done by just sensible people. People, you know, big businesses should realize, you know, this isn't a real recession. We should just be, you know, we've got zero interest rates. We've got some capital. We should just accept the payments are going to come in late. It's really about these sectors that don't have that ability to do that. You know, your restaurant owner who's living month to month and things like that, how do they do it? That's the really tough part here. And different countries have had different approaches. You know, the U.S. is a big country. It's thrown a lot of money at this. But it's not just throwing the money. It's like, how do you work out how to distribute it? Is a very difficult thing. And they actually did one clever thing. They let the banks distribute some of this money for loans. And there's some rationale for that. The banks kind of know who's the people. There might be ways of having them have a bit of skin in the game there. And so it might turn out to be a good way to go. But this is what I told you. It's all on the fly.
My guest today is economist Joshua Ganz. He's a professor of strategic management at the University of Toronto and the author of Economics in the Age of COVID-19. I want to ask about one question you were talking about, which is, again, getting back to reopening, in which there'll have to be macroeconomic stimuluses at the time of reopening to get things moving again. Of course, the U.S. government has already sent a stimulus, or is in the process of still sending a stimulus to citizens. You write that maybe that might have been a little premature. Why is that?
Well, it's really an objection to the word stimulus. You know, the normal reason those checks get sent, and there's been times when that's happened. It happened after 9/11, and it happened in the 2008 crisis as well, was because people would say, oh, the economy is going to be bad. I shouldn't buy stuff, especially if it's around, you know, Christmas time, et cetera, et cetera. So you send them some checks and say, hey, if you're still pulling up here. Here's some extra money for you. Maybe keep things going. But this time around, there's a few issues. Now, there's one sense in which there's a lot of people who take that money and have things to spend it on. They'll give money to the bank or to the landlord or spend it on food and other things like that. And that's all well and good. But it's not a stimulus in the sense of saying, now you should also spend on other stuff, for the excellent reason is there is no other stuff to spend on. What we want is, once we've decided that the restaurants are reopened, for instance, we want people to actually give them a little push to go out and start using restaurants again once we've decided they're safe. And you can see how a stimulus might help for those things, or to get people even traveling again or whatever. That I can see some rationale there. But that's an end-of-crisis mechanism, not a in-crisis mechanism.
Interesting. Yeah, no, I get that. Well, one area where I think might be a real success story is on finding a vaccine. I think Pfizer announced today that they may have a vaccine ready to go by the end of the year. And you have a number of companies working on vaccines today. And it seems like it's all hands on deck within the pharmaceutical industry to find a vaccine. You write extensively about the vaccine. What do you think about all these multiple efforts and what we're likely to see when we get to the point of a vaccine?
I'm very pleased about the multiple efforts to find the vaccine. Once that is done, we will have the issue of distributing it. And there's no economy set up, you know, and we're talking worldwide. So worldwide distribution of a vaccine, that is a big ask. If you just think about it for a second, we're having trouble testing people. Well, how are we going to get enough vaccines, which are actually more complicated to make and do and distribute it? How are we going to get enough of those to different people? And how are we going to ensure that we know who we're vaccinated and who we haven't? And how are we going to ensure that people don't get all panicky about it and start, you know, when you dangle a get-out-of-jail-free card, people tend to rush towards it. So what are you going to do there? So that's the part that is more difficult to think through. Now, the good news about that is I've just outlined the problem. So it's actually a well-known problem that this is going to occur. The bad news, because there isn't a solution, there's going to be some sort of rationing process for this, and it will have to be set up. And, you know, the CDC even has guidelines for that sort of thing. For instance, you know, the first people get vaccines are normally pregnant women and children, et cetera. Well, now we have to think, actually, do we want it to be children?
Right.
Is that the order we want? You know, maybe we want to do it a different way. Do we want it to be the elderly, or do we want it to be people who are going to go to work in certain environments? Who the hell knows? So that's going to have to be decided. And whatever you do there, it's a hiding to nothing. No one's going to be happy. You can explain as much as you want, but you're going to have Mahatma Gandhi type skills to be able to sell that.
I keep thinking back to the movie Contagion and from the Vietnam draft in the 60s, where it was basically the lottery, you know, where, you know, all 365 days in a big hopper, and you just pull out the days.
There will be a lottery. I'm sure there'll be a lottery, because the lottery is perceived to be the thing that occurs. But there'll be exceptions to the lottery, and then people will be upset about it. Fortunately, once that is all done, we're vaccinated and we're off. So, you know, a vaccine is a good news, but it's not a good news that has an instant effect. It's a good news because it gives us the ability to say this will be over by this date.
Yeah. The name of the book is Economics in the Age of COVID-19. Professor Gans, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Economist Joshua Gans teaches at the University of Toronto and is the author of Economics in the Age of COVID-19. It's published by MIT Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.